May it please the court. I'm Frederick Haynes, First Assistant Attorney General and Assistant Solicitor General for the appellant, Colorado Department of Transportation. If this were a case about a fire started by a cigarette dropped by a passing motorist into tumbleweeds collected under a bridge that then burned down, then we would not be here today. But that is not our case. We are here because this case is about a 9,000-acre firestorm that struck Crowley County on April 15, 2008, that created its own wind of superheated air in front of the fire, that burned at temperatures between 400 to 1,200 degrees, that burned everything in its path, including railroad ties inlaid in a rock bed, utility poles, the tops of great cottonwood trees, many homes and buildings in and near the town of Ordway, and not just one bridge, but two bridges, side by side, spanning the Numa Ditch, just west of Lane 16 outside Ordway, Colorado. There may have been tumbleweeds under the highway bridge because they had been found there before, but we can't know whether tumbleweeds were under the bridge that afternoon because winds were high and tumbleweeds travel on the wind. What we do know, because Albert Reimenschneider saw it and testified to it, is that there were no weeds under the adjacent railroad bridge to the north of Highway 96 that suffered the same fate as the bridge on Highway 96. Whether or not there were tumbleweeds under the bridge on Highway 96 was irrelevant to its fate because the bridge was built of creosote-treated timbers, the same as the adjacent railroad bridge. And as the fire approached with flames topping 10 feet, 25 feet, 30 feet, according to witness Mr. Miller and Agent Ellis, the CBI fire investigator, superheated winds went ahead of it, reliquefying creosote in the timbers, bringing it to the surface and igniting the creosote at temperatures above 350 degrees, well below the temperature of the firestorm that day.
The council, for jurisdictional purposes, the question that's before us, under Powell, the actual liability is not really the issue, is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The liability is not at issue. It's a question of whether the Department of Transportation's immunity has been waived here. And so the issue that is before the court concerns the construction to be placed on the words of the statutory definition of a dangerous condition in section 2410.103.1. And those
and
words,
would like us to use the words but for, is that right?
I would like you to apply a but for test where the statute requires a showing of proximate cause, that the negligence of the public entity or public employee, and in that case, in this case, it's CDOT. The negligence of the public entity must have proximately caused the condition which is claimed to be to result in the injuries.
What's the proximate cause? Sole proximate? A contributing factor? Has our Supreme Court said that it's a but-for test that's applied in this context?
Yes, Your Honor. In this context, I'm unaware of a case that has directly construed the words proximately caused. However, in the case of State versus Moldovan, the court held that because CDOT had negligently failed to repair a right-of-way fence, a cow was able to get through the hole in the fence and wander onto the highway, thus creating a dangerous condition, so that effectively, but for the negligence of CDOT in failing to repair that fence, the dangerous condition would not have occurred.
Since you're talking about Moldovan, I want to ask you how you reconcile the statement by the Supreme Court in Medina when it was talking about Moldovan, that the fact that the state allowed the fence to fall into disrepair also contributed to the plaintiff's injuries, and thus we find a waiver of immunity under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. It seems that the Supreme Court in Medina, when it was talking about Moldovan, was not talking about a but-for test, but a contribution type of test.
Well, in fact, Your Honor, in Moldovan and in Medina, the issue of proximate cause was not before the court. Now, the court used language in Medina referring to Moldovan, saying that CDOT's failure to repair that fence contributed to the injuries, in the sense that it was the cow that wandered onto the road and caused the dangerous condition that the motorist collided with and was injured. It wasn't a CDOT truck or something like that, but nevertheless, it was CDOT's negligence in failing to repair that fence that created the proximate cause of the dangerous condition. That is, that but for that negligence, the cow could not have wandered onto the road. And so I think that where the statute uses proximate cause, the legislature intends those words to have a specific meaning. And in the Supreme Court's case in Tidwell, for instance, it was concerned with the words results from that appear in section 2410.1061. And it said that where the legislature uses the words results from and caused by in the same statute, it must intend different meanings for those words. And in this case, we're concerned with the language proximately caused by, which the legislature intends to be applied in a certain way, because those words have specific meaning under Colorado law. And in every situation that I have been able to find, those words mean, at least in modern times, that it satisfy a but-for test. And
the court in Tidwell did note that nothing in our previous cases or the statute requires a plaintiff to show that his injuries were caused by the public entity's conduct in the tort sense.
Yeah.
When talking about the jurisdictional issue that's being raised in this case.
Well, it was not exactly the same jurisdictional issue, if I may, Your Honor. The court in Tidwell was construing section 2410.1061 and the waiver that continues in subsection A for the operation of a motor vehicle. And it said that where injuries result from the operation of a motor vehicle, there is no causation requirement in the tort sense for the waiver to be established. But the court specifically contrasted other provisions of the CGIA, in particular 2410.1061D, related to a dangerous condition of a highway or a dangerous condition of a sidewalk, and said where the statute requires caused by, that those words mean something different from results from. Now, in the case that the court was considering in Tidwell, the words caused by had no bearing.
Did the court ever say caused by means but for?
Not in Tidwell, Your Honor.
Has it ever said that in any case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Caused by means but for?
that proximate cause means but for. And
in the context of a jurisdictional issue under the Governmental Immunity Act?
No, Your Honor, not that I'm aware of. However, it's my position that when the legislature uses the term proximately caused by, it has a great deal of history behind it and a great deal of other uses of those terms. And wherever those words have come up in the law outside of the immunity context, they require a but-for test.
But wouldn't your interpretation of the statute require the plaintiff to prove his tort case in a jurisdictional context hearing?
I think that actually frequently there is an overlap in the Trinity process where plaintiffs must prove that there has been a waiver of immunity and then the merits of the case that might be tried to a jury later. I believe that happens as a result of the language of the CGIA itself. Where a court must find certain jurisdictional facts that bear on immunity and waivers of immunity, and its findings of those facts do not bind the jury later.
Go back to the Powell case, reading a little further, it says whether the state is immune and whether it is liable are two distinct inquiries. Accordingly, at this stage, we do not address issues of negligence or causation. But it sounds like, effectively, you want us to address the issue of causation here.
Well, I think that the plain words of the statute require that the court find that the dangerous condition was proximately caused by the negligence of the public entity.
Mr. Haynes, I just want to remind you have about 2.5 minutes left if you intend to reserve any time.
Your Honor. I would like to reserve those few minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
Lee Sternal, Pueblo, representing Appley Schwartz. And before I actually begin my argument, I'd like to ask you to allow me to make a few minor corrections to my brief, which of course was filed without any knowledge that it was going to be distributed among 10 different school districts. And the subject of far more intention than
perhaps we should stop the clock for just a moment here since we're not talking substance.
Thank you.
What kind of do you have in mind?
Well, at page 20, somehow there was a case inserted there that never should have been there. I just wanted to delete that at the last line before you start conclusion. I wanted you to know that I do not believe the city of Littleton is at all supportive of that premise. That somehow that was there that didn't get deleted in the proofreading. So that's at page 20, just above conclusion. And at page 11, the next to the last sentence, I had this, it was supposed to be the year 2000. Instead, it says 2002, and this is in reference to the number of years these bridge inspection reports had been made, which had been noting the presence of the tumbleweeds. So that was something else I missed. Page 9, I have an egregious English error here where it says Appley Schwartz does not agree, that it should just be agree, not plural.
We generally recognize that there are typographical errors made in briefs, and we don't hold that against counsel for missing the spelling of a word or something like that. So I think we're okay with your briefs the way they are.
Well,
I appreciate that. It's a tough crowd out there. I think you're forgiving as well.
Well, I can imagine some of them are thinking, there's a lawyer out there that doesn't know the difference between agree and agrees, so I just wanted to point that out.
Okay.
And at the Roman numeral page 2, the citation for the case that I can't pronounce, which is something like Schwedisky, that should be 934 Pacific 2nd, 1380. And with those remarks, those corrections, I'll now start my rebuttal argument by also saying, may it please the court.
Excuse me just a moment. Mr. Haynes, I assume you have no objections to any of those corrections. All right, thank you.
And as I use that phrase, may it please the court, I also want you to know that I've often wondered where it started, because I'm assuming it was something that began in our English common law system, and I've always felt a little uncomfortable using it, but it's more appropriate perhaps that it be used in this case, since we're talking about something that may be even older than that phrase, and that is this concept of sovereign immunity. And in fact, the earliest written reference, as you probably all know, to the concept that the king can do no wrong is probably a letter that was written in AD 494 by Pope Galatius I to Emperor Anastasius. Now, as fascinating as this history of sovereign immunity is, I'm sure you're each aware that I am most unhappy that the office of our Attorney General thinks he has grounds to have filed the appeal that brings us all together here today. And we should not have to be here, because the but-for test is the basic concept of causation, and causation is the question for the trier of fact. And Justice Bender in 1997 wrote the opinion for our Supreme Court in the Schwedisky case, and he specifically said, causation is properly resolved by the trier of fact. Now, what we've got here is a great argument that the Attorney General has made if it was directed at the issue of summary judgment. Then he could talk about causation all he wants, but this isn't a summary judgment situation. This was a Rule 12b-1 where the only issue was, does the court have the power to hear the case? And the scope of this limited interlocutory power has been greatly exceeded, and the Attorney General has conceded. He's trying to expand the scope of what has traditionally been the issue. Jurisdiction is typically challenged by this motion, this 12b-1, and there are issues that are valid from time to time, such as, was notice given timely? Was the notice to the correct public entity? Was the notice sufficient? But that is far different from the but-for argument. And as you have acknowledged, you clearly understand, they're asking to take two bites out of the apple. They want me and every other litigant who has a claim against the state to have to prove liability before they're allowed to go in and prove it again to whoever's going to be the trier of fact. And that, of course, is a hugely unfair circumstance, especially when you're talking about what it costs to have to prove liability these days. You know, the goal of this whole action is to get the state to pay the limited inadequate amount of $150,000, and you have all seen cases in which the costs that have been awarded against someone who doesn't win one of these cases the costs alone exceed $150,000. And so here we are being forced, according to the Attorney General, to have to prove our liability case before we even get to go in and prove it again.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Sternel. Granted, I asked Mr. Haynes about the Medina case when it talked about the Moldovan case and using the words also contributed to the plaintiff's injuries. However, there is other language in the Medina case when the court is talking about holding an evidentiary hearing, which you did, and the court says that this will enable the trial court to determine whether the dangerous condition of the road that caused plaintiff's injuries developed through lack of maintenance subsequent to the road's initial design and construction, or whether the injury was attributable solely to the risk inherent in the design. But my point is, there is language in the Medina case that refers to the dangerous condition causing the plaintiff's injuries, as that is understood in the jurisdictional context and in the evidentiary hearing to determine jurisdiction. So how do you reconcile that with the contribution language of Moldovan?
Well, I think you can look at what the Supreme Court said in the Tidwell case, which talked about this issue as being a burden that's minimal in nature. Yes, there has to be some connection to it. And in fact, however, it's a very minimal issue. And when you look at what the Attorney General said when he indicated that we would not be here if this in fact had been a case of a cigarette that had been thrown off the bridge and got into a pile of tumbleweeds that had been allowed to accumulate for years under the bridge, we probably wouldn't be here. Well, why? I guess it's because he's assuming that they would recognize that that in fact was a dangerous condition for which they were liable. But the point is that what we're talking about in this case isn't an issue in terms of whether or not the bridge burned. The question we're talking about is whether it was a reasonable thing to allow these tumbleweeds to exist under this bridge for all those years when the manual that the highway department uses describes them as a fire hazard. So in respect to this issue of proximate cause, it is only necessary to show that there was some kind of negligent activity in the maintenance of the bridge. And in this case, we've got these bridge inspection reports that for 8 years talked about these tumbleweeds being piled under there and not being removed. And when the Attorney General says that there was this landowner who was testifying about what was the existing condition of the railroad bridge to the north, he's overlooked that at page 124 of the transcript, Mr. Reibenheimer, I'm also butchering his name, said that he did not look under the railroad bridge. So he couldn't testify that there were no weeds under it. And then, of course, we don't want to forget what Agent Ellis, the fire inspector for the division, the Colorado inspector, not general, but he was the employee of the state of Colorado who was their former fire inspector. He said he looked at another similar wooden bridge within about a 15-mile radius, and it was packed with tumbleweeds. So we have a situation here where there's really no question about the proximate cause being...
Well, counsel, let me ask you this. If the bridge would have burned to the ground, regardless of the tumbleweed collection, how is the state bridge proximate cause?
It falls into a causal set. Now, if you're going to talk about that scenario, that's a question of fact to be resolved by the finders of fact. In other words, it's a valid jury question. Would the bridge have burned if, in fact, the tumbleweeds had not been under it? I mean, we can make great arguments on both sides of that. But the point is, for the purposes of what brings us here, it's not relevant because the only issue is, did we allege facts which concern a dangerous condition? And the point is that They've acknowledged if there were tumbleweeds under the bridge, that's a fire hazard, according to their own manual. And apparently, if somebody had tossed a cigarette out and started it on fire instead of the fire being swept into it. Now, keep in mind as well that the state had an obligation to keep the right-of-way maintained. The evidence in the record is that that right-of-way was about 30 feet from the bridge in each direction. And you have to ask, okay, if in fact there'd been no tumbleweeds allowed to accumulate within 30 feet of the bridge, would the bridge have burned? But that's an issue that we have to resolve at trial, not to be able to get to trial.
Now those are factual issues to be resolved at trial, but we have a legal issue here of whether or not you have to prove proximate cause for the injury that your client suffered in order to fall within the waiver provisions of the Governmental Immunity Act. Let me ask you this. I want to go back to Medina because you rely on Medina for your contribution argument. And Medina, this is the Supreme Court. I'm wondering if you can tell me what the Supreme Court means by this. To prove that the state has waived immunity and thus the court has jurisdiction under 12b-1, plaintiffs must prove that their injuries were caused by a breach of the state's duty to maintain the highway. Now it's talking about jurisdiction. It's not talking about the final tort claim determination. The claimants must prove that their injuries were caused by a breach of the state's duty to maintain the highway.
Well, the breach.
How does that reconcile with the contribution theory?
Well, first of all, there's a causal set that's also part of this proximate cause situation, and that was addressed in the Union Carbide case, the June v. Union Carbide case. In other words, if the tumbleweeds under the bridge were the fuel source that caused the timbers to catch on fire, which is what Ellis said in his opinion, the only one who was the qualified fire inspector said, look, the tumbleweeds caused the bridge timbers to burn. What we have here is a situation where you can't deny that there was 100% obstruction of traffic on the highway because the bridge burned and the highway dropped off. So in terms of how that fits in with Medina, the maintenance is the issue. The highway department had the obligation to maintain that bridge in the condition that it had been in when it was put into service in 1937. And part of that maintenance activity specifically included removing the tumbleweeds, and we see it in time and time again. It's noted they even took a picture of it and drew a diagram of it at one point, showing all these tumbleweeds underneath that east end of the bridge, and they never had a single report showing they ever took them out. Nobody ever testified they took those tumbleweeds out, because all they cared about was whether or not there was water that could flow under the middle of the bridge, and they didn't care about the tumbleweeds at the end. So the point is, yes, there is proximate cause that is a problem for anybody who is trying to make a claim against the state, but it's just a minimal issue, and it's not the issue that we would face if we were in court trying to win the case in front of a jury. But the standard that the Attorney General is asking us to prove is exactly the same. There's no difference between what he would be expecting us to prove to be able to get into court versus what we would have to prove if we were actually there. And that is just a perversion of the whole purpose of this limited interlocutory appellate right that they have. So, of course, the reason that I have filed this brief is also to ask that you use this as an example. You give the Attorney General notice that they aren't going to be able to get away with this two bites out of the apple that they like to try to do. And I wonder how many other times other people have just given up and not fought it out because the cost of the experts would be too great. And I've pointed out to you that they are not immune. They are not immune from having a cost assessment against them for having filed a groundless action. And I've given you the case where that was the Graber case, and was the Colorado City Metro District v. Graber, and this is a groundless appeal, and I ask that you remand it to the district court with the order that they have a hearing as to a reasonable attorney fee to be awarded to Schwartz, because if we lost that 12B, they'd be there asking that their attorney's fees be awarded against him. So this is a good opportunity to stop this process and not allow this sovereign to abuse the subjects such as John Schwartz. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Haynes, you have 2 minutes and 25 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, the primary task of this court is to determine and give effect to the intent of the legislature according to Bertrand versus Board of County Commissioners. And to do that, it must look to the statutory language and give words and phrases their plain and ordinary meaning. And the court must not adopt a construction of this statute that renders any term superfluous, according to People versus Madden and People X Rel NDV cases that I cited in my opening brief.
Mr. Haynes, I hate to interrupt your last 2 minutes, but I didn't get to ask you this question before. The statute, you're talking about a but-for test because of the proximately caused language in the statute. And I know that the proximately caused language is used in this sense. It says, which condition, which is the dangerous condition, is proximately caused by the negligent act or omission of the public entity in constructing or maintaining such facility. So The statute doesn't appear to be talking about proximately causing the injury.
Correct.
It seems to be talking about the dangerous condition.
Correct.
Being proximately caused by the, the state's negligence.
We are talking about the existence of a dangerous condition, and the dangerous condition must be one that interferes with the movement of traffic on the traveled portion of the highway. There is no contention that tumbleweeds collected underneath the bridge in any way interfered with the movement of traffic unless they were the cause, the proximate cause of the bridge not being there. That was the dangerous condition from which injuries resulted, was the bridge not being there. And so if and the reason for the illustration that I started my argument with is this would be an entirely different case if tumbleweeds were determined to be the proximate cause of the bridge burning down. But in this case, they cannot be. And the proof that they cannot be is the fate of the railroad bridge to the north, the fate of utility poles and the string along the north side of the highway, and also all the railroad ties that were inlaid in a rock bed that had no tumbleweeds underneath them.
I see your time is up, Mr. Haynes.
Thank you.
Thank you for your argument, and thank you, Mr. Sternel and Mr. Haynes, both of you, for your excellent arguments. Thank you for coming out here today and helping with the students' education. And this matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.